where it, we are interviewing Professor Mark Perelman at his home for the National Council of Jewish Women. This is February the 29th, 96. I'm Howard Braun and Ruth Saul. Would you please say a word?
The United Nations is a weak straw upon which to lean.
When we finished the last time, you were interrupted in the midst of a sentence where you were discussing the fact that your father had brought his parents here at a time when there was great economic difficulty and it was an embarrassment.
I don't recall exactly what I was saying, but it was something to the effect that my grandfather, Perelman, had written to my father saying that there was absolutely nothing left, and he would have to, he really would have to come to America. And this put my father in a difficult position, he felt. Living in Madison, which was friendly community to Jews, and working for a professor, John R. Commons, who opposed open immigration of the poor from Europe. My father had to go to Commons and explain his the dilemma or the pickle in which he found himself. And Commons, in his autobiography, which goes by the title of Myself, mentions how my father came to him in great distress and asked for help. And Commons helped him. He increased his stipend as a graduate assistant and made it possible for my father to bring his parents and his younger brother Jacob over. Initially, they were to settle in Woonsocket, W-O-N-S-O-C-K-E-T, Rhode Island, where my grandmother's brother lived. But they were unhappy there, and then my father decided that he would have to bring them to Madison. Now, my father did not try to appear anything other than what he was, but he wished to give the appearance to Commons that he was a Russian Jewish intellectual and was not necessarily part of the great immigration of poor Russian Jews. But with his parents in town, he moved to what was then the Jewish ghetto in Madison, an area called Greenbush, and lived with his parents and his brother. For my father, this was quite a humiliation. It is easy these days, when such distinctions are not crucial, to be critical of people like my father who sought to be something other than what they are. In those days, it meant putting his relationship with Commons to considerable test, and that is what happened. It is interesting to me that when my father married in 1918, my mother and my father maintained a close relationship with his parents, the kind of household they ran was what we could call Middle West upper class.
It's Jack Markowitz.
In any event, the pattern of life which my parents established was academic upper class, linen tablecloths, relatively formal dining habits, dinners to which people were invited, and there was conversation during and after dinner. Now, as I look back, I recognize that his posture may seem to have been a form of snobbery, and that it surely was. On the other hand, he was of the generation that pulled himself up by his bootstraps, and one, if one wants to change one's culture, the act of changing one's culture is often an act of snobbery. In any event, his parents came to live in Madison. He put his younger brother through a university high school and supported him while he went through the University of Wisconsin, getting first a baccalaureate, then a master's, and then a PhD. So from the standpoint of family loyalty, my father certainly passes all of the tests. I might add parenthetically that he was much more generous in the education of his brother than he was in the education of any of his own children. We did not go to the university high school, we went to the public schools. When I wanted to go to, I was offered a scholarship to Swarthmore, he refused to sign the paper saying that there was insufficient money to pay for the scholarship, claiming that if he wanted to pay for the scholarship, he could. But he didn't. He wanted to pay the tuition, he could.
What was your uncle's name?
Jacob. Jacob Perlman. Mm-hmm. I might mention parenthetically that Jacob had a teaching career, eventually ending up at the University of North Dakota, where after not being paid for a period of time during the Depression, he went to Washington, became a major economist in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and then the chief statistician for the old Social Security Board. He went on later on to become one of the directors of the National Science Foundation, having in the interim served as a UN chief of mission in economic affairs in Bolivia, then Greece, and finally in the Philippine Islands.
Mm-hmm. You haven't spoken about your own family, your children or grandchildren. Can you tell us things about them?
Yes. Nomi and I were married in 1953. And in 1958, we adopted a baby girl whom we named Abigail. At the time we got her, she was 3 days old. And so from the standpoint of parentage, we were it. It was a very clever little girl.
Year was it you adopted her?
I'm sorry?
What year was it you adopted?
1958. And she was rather a very clever little girl, for reasons not completely clear to us. She did not take to the schooling process with much enthusiasm, and eventually finished high school on time, had no objection to going to college, and going to classes was her problem, and with the inevitable result. Eventually, she decided, she was married and divorced, and she decided that she ought to get a baccalaureate degree because by this time she had a little boy, and she took 3 years college work and 1 year at Duquesne University, taking the courses largely by examination, managed to finish in 11 months the 3 years worth of college credit, taking care of her little boy, working part-time because I thought that work was essential to her self-esteem, and being ardently courted by three chief residents. She married one of them. In due course, they have had three additional children. The household actually consists of five children because shortly after, a year after she got married, one of her neighbors, a convert to Catholicism, said that their church had decided to bring over a Filipino workman with two babies who needed surgery. The surgery the two babies needed was separation. They were Siamese twins joined at the chest with a fused liver. The family which was to take care of the Filipino group found that they could not handle the freak element. And the neighbor said to Abby, you are a nurse, your husband is a doctor, and your son David can handle anything. So would you take care of them for 10 days or 2 weeks at the very most? Well, it is now almost 6 years later, and they're still there, although there was surgery and one of the little girls was lost. Abby has...
What are the sexes of the five?
Abby has three boys. Current ages are David, who is 10, Justin, who is 8, and Daniel, who is 6. And she has a little girl, Alexandra, who is now 3. Noevie, spelled N-O-E-V-I-E, Buenaventura, is the little Filipina girl. And how long she will be a member of the household, we do not know.
Millie, Ben, what did you say that name was?
Buenaventura, B-E-N-E-V-E-N-T-U-R-A. The father, Abby has a very large house in the middle of a group of very small houses, so it's a salvation physically, but probably economically a disaster. The father of the little Filipina girl, whose given name is Noel, lives in the basement with a little girl, but the little girl spends most of her time in Abby's household. The plan is that at some point a Noevie will be large enough to undergo a series of surgical reconstruction of her chest wall. The skeletal frame, or a sufficient part of the skeletal frame of the deceased Siamese twin has been frozen and is kept available so that at some point they will use that to try to reconstruct a chest wall for Noevie. Mm-hmm. If the current plan is that the father and the daughter must return to the Philippine Islands because of the visa situation. A great many years have passed since they originally came into the country, and I'm not as convinced that they will go back as perhaps the immigration authorities.
Why does this child, you seem to be emphasizing it more time-wise than remark, just a quick remark about why do you do that?
Well, I think that the child is with the family, but not of the family.
Mm-hmm.
She's an insecure little girl. I have a lot of sympathy for her. It complicates family life.
Mm-hmm.
Meantime, Abby has gone on, and she was a registered nurse, and then she took a law degree. She worked for a long while as middle management of the University of Massachusetts General Hospital, about 2 years ago was laid off as part of the middle management reconstruction. Her husband, Kenneth Williams, is a great believer in education, and he had, as I mentioned, pushed her off to law school, where she got a law degree. And then while she was waiting for another job, she took a public health degree at Harvard, MPH. And she now is working in a law firm as a medical malpractice lawyer, and apparently is on the basis of the number of raises she's gotten in the last 12 months, which has increased her salary by more than two-thirds. She is doing quite well.
Bringing up this nursing and the medical problems makes me think, can you contrast the medical care when you were a child with today's?
Well, this is a field in which I've lectured considerably. When I was at the University of Pittsburgh, my principal appointment was in economics. But I also had joint appointments in public health and in history. Of course, the whole medical scene has very much changed. It is virtually impossible to explain to young people what the medical experience of people our generation was. I recall at the time we got married, when Naomi and I were contemplating having children, we were very concerned that she not become pregnant at such time as to leave her in an advanced stage of pregnancy during the polio epidemics, which were usually in July and August. A great number of women who were pregnant at that period, who developed polio, developed a bulbar, B-U-L-B-E-R variety, which put them in iron lungs for such period as they remained alive. Prior to World War II, children died of mastoiditis, there being no effective antibiotics to cure it.
What years are you talking about?
Well, antibiotics became generally available to the population only after World War II. I want to come back to that in a minute. There were some sulfanilamide drugs which the Germans had developed
year.
In the 1930s, but antibiotics as such, particularly penicillin, was made available to the general population only after World War II. During World War II, particularly in the later years, it was available to the military. But there is an interesting story there. My older brother David had gone through the University of Wisconsin in chemistry. He did not have a particularly distinguished record, and he failed to get fellowship assistance for his graduate work from the Department of Chemistry. One of my father's old friends and former colleagues was the wife of a professor of biochemistry, and with perhaps some urging from my father, the Department of Biochemistry, at that time considered somewhat junior to the Department of Chemistry, offered David an industrial fellowship, which he took. He had had some interest in antibiotics, simply because he had borrowed my bicycle at one point and had ridden down to Peoria, Illinois as a vacation. And while he was there, he saw the first effort to make antibiotics on a vat capacity. Previous to that, penicillin had been grown in only very small batches. Well, the first effort and many others failed. Well, it turned out that his assignment on his industrial fellowship was to work to develop a reagent for the development of penicillin. The industrial fellowship was sponsored by Hoffmann LaRoche, a Swiss firm, and David managed to discover this reagent on his first experiment. Mm-hmm. He held many patents before he died, I think somewhere in the number of 200, he never had such luck again. He did not own the patent, but it is in his name. Hoffmann LaRoche owned the patent, and the difference between discovering the reagent and producing it is a PhD versus several hundred million dollars. Well, David got the PhD. But the medical treatment since that time has very much changed. When I was at Johns Hopkins, I remember the president of the university, Milton Eisenhower, commenting that 85% of the prescriptions written in 1961 could not have been written in 1950. Or maybe he meant 1940, but as I recall, it was 1950. The whole technique of medical care has changed. In many senses, the results can be nothing but positively spectacular. However, the role of physicians in medical care has changed very much, and the role of professional nursing has changed very much. And in large measure, the personal relationships previously associated with both of those roles have very much diminished.
That's very interesting. I'd like to go back a little bit further. Can you tell us more about any political or cultural involvements in Madison and changes that may have occurred after you came to Pittsburgh?
Yes. The Madison in which I lived in the 1930s was very much dominated by the La Follette family. The older senator, one-time governor, La Follette, had died in 1923. He had run for the presidency in 1920 and managed to pick up 3 million votes, which was no small achievement. But when he died, his older son was appointed and then was elected to finish his father's term first and then his own career in the Senate. The La Follette party in Wisconsin, it was the progressive wing of the Republican Party, had been responsible for all of the great legislative reforms in Wisconsin. Governor La Follette, the old man, had combined forces with a very brilliant historian, a PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin by the name of Charles McCarthy. Here I digress, but it's an interesting story. Charles McCarthy spoke with a very heavy Irish accent. He came from a very Irish family from Rhode Island. He was an extraordinarily able football player and had been given a football fellowship to Brown University. At the time he entered Brown University, there was the son of one of the richest men in America who also entered as a freshman. And he had his father, John D. Rockefeller Sr., wanted his son to acquire the common touch. So John D. Rockefeller Jr. and Charles McCarthy were roommates for the period they were undergraduates at Brown University. That friendship continued, and I mentioned in passing that the terms of the friendship were very interesting. When McCarthy was married, John D. Rockefeller Jr. sent him a check for $10,000 as a wedding gift. $10,000 in 1910 or so was probably somewhere close to the equivalent of $400,000 now. McCarthy returned the check, saying that their friendship had nothing to do with money. And I mention this because I remember that McCarthy's had a cottage on the other side of Lake Mendota. And as a child, my father would go over and visit his widow and one of his daughters, and I remember going along. It was a very modest cottage, sort of thing our family might have had.
Was this the Charles McCarthy playwright?
No, not connected at all. Okay. There are several McCarthys in this world, and this McCarthy was a progressive, he was a social scientist. Mm-hmm. McCarthy and my father's teacher, John R. Cummins, were responsible for setting up the workmen's compensation system in Wisconsin, which was the first successful one developed. It was initially held to be unconstitutional, and to its amazement, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which had just held it unconstitutional, was petitioned by the employers to rehear the arguments, and they declared the bill constitutional. McCarthy's element was the legislature elected in 1910, and McCarthy, who ran what was called the Legislative Reference Library, a service which produced not only research but actually the wording of bills for the legislature, managed to bring to the university, to the Capitol in Madison, once or twice a week during the 3 months that the legislature sat, I believe in 1911, speakers from all over the world. And from these speakers, the legislature got the idea to set up the vocational educational system in Wisconsin, an idea patterned on the Prussian system. They got the idea of considering various forms of social insurance from what was being passed in Britain, representatives in the Parliament having come. And it was a very intellectual community. Now, this progressivism in Wisconsin had a very strong German element to it. La Follette's political base was Norwegian, but the socialist community in Germany, in Milwaukee, came from Germany, largely from Catholic parts of Germany, particularly from Bavaria. And during World War I, La Follette, who was an outstanding isolationist and who very much opposed American entry into the war, lost much of his university support. The faculty of the university was very much oriented, as elsewhere, to the preservation of English cultural dominance. And the professors of the university signed a round-robin letter, including the Professor Collins, disavowing their previous affiliation with Senator La Follette. And the consequence was that during the post-war period, there was a great deal of American ambivalence, a great deal of ambivalence in the Madison community. I remember when I was a small boy, the variant of the cops and robbers game, or the cowboys and Indians game, was the allies in Bosch or Hun game. And I generally elected to be a Bosch or a Hun on the grounds that the general view was Germany, in terms of its defeat of the Tsarist government, was to be commended. Germany, in terms of its defeat by the Allies, was considered to be less of a social advance. In any event, in the 1930s, the pro-German feeling was still quite strong. My father's, one of my father's closest friends, Edmund Witte, who incidentally was responsible for the development of the 1935 Social Security Bill in Washington, Edmund Witte was quite pro-German. My father's other closest friend, Martin Glaser, G-L-A-E-S-E-R, a public utility economist, and who was clearly the most intimate of my father's college students and friends, was so pro-German in the 1930s that the friendship completely broke. When Witte went to Europe in 1937 or 1938, he chose to sail on the North German Lloyd line, which was a German line, something for which my father had no understanding of the many things, of the many harsh things at times he said about Witte. The only one that stands out in my mind as really bitter was his question of how could the Wittes have done such a thing. But the general view in Wisconsin was that the German culture was the counterbalance to the English culture. And from a social development standpoint, prior to 1933, when Hitler came to power, Germany was far in advance of either England or France in terms of social reform. On that subject, I might mention that I can remember the precise day when my father decided that he had no longer any affinity for the German culture. It was probably on June 16th or 15th, 1934, when Hitler had executed the leader of the Brown Shirts. His name was Rome. Captain Fritz Röhm. And my father came home from the office for his our usual midday meal, which was the big meal, carrying, as was his wont, the Chicago Tribune with the story of the execution. And I must have been at that time 9 years old. And I remember he is saying very dramatically, if Hitler does this to his own, what will he do to his enemies? From that moment on, the Hitler regime was no longer perceived to be a passing unhappy phase. It was the damnation of a great culture.
Do you feel that being Jewish in Madison made a big difference in your particular
feelings? Yes. My mother had been, as I mentioned previously, quite an observant Jew. She died in 1930, and as I mentioned earlier, my father married my mother's sister about 6 months later. And amongst the many things that were maintained in the household was the observance of the Sabbath, the observance of the kashrut, and the certainly the observance of all of the Jewish holidays, not only the high holidays and the Passover, but also Sukkot and Shavuot. I recall that one of the neighbor women, Mrs. Henry Eubank, Eubank, her husband,